Side 9. The Dark Half by Stephen King. Continuing on page 332. It was a large and silent Detroit necropolis, and it gave Thad the creeps. He made a right turn, then a left. Suddenly he could see sparrows everywhere, perched on roofs and trunks and greasy amputated engines. He saw a trio of the small birds bathing in a hubcap filled with water. They did not fly away as he approached, but stopped what they were doing and watched him with their beady black eyes. Sparrows lined the top of a windshield which leaned against the side of an old Plymouth. He passed within 3 feet of them. They fluttered their wings nervously but held their positions as he passed. The harbingers of the living dead, Thad thought. His hand went to the small white scar on his forehead and began to rub it nervously. Looking through what appeared to be a meteor hole in the windshield of a Datsun as he passed it, he observed a wide splash of dried blood on the dashboard. It wasn't a meteor that made that hole, he thought, and his stomach turned over slowly and giddily. A congregation of sparrows sat on the Datsun's front seat.
"What do you want with me?" he asked hoarsely. "What in God's name do you want?"
And in his mind, he seemed to hear an answer of sorts. In his mind, he seemed to hear the shrill single voice of their avian intelligence.
"No, Thad. What do you want with us? You are the owner. You are the bringer. You are the knower."
"I don't know jack shit," he muttered. At the end of this row, space was available in front of a late-model Cutlass Supreme. Someone had amputated its entire front end. He backed the Suburban in and got out. Looking from one side of the narrow aisle to the other, Thad felt a little bit like a rat in a maze. The place smelled of oil and the higher, sourer odor of transmission fluid. There were no sounds but the faraway drone of cars on Route 2. The sparrows looked at him from everywhere, a silent convocation of small, brown-black birds. Then abruptly they took wing all at once, hundreds of them, perhaps 1,000. For a moment the air was harsh with the sound of their wings. They flocked across the sky, then banked west, in the direction where Castle Rock lay. And abruptly he began to feel that crawling sensation again, not so much on his skin as inside it. "Are we trying to have a little peek, George?" Under his breath he began to sing a Bob Dylan song. John Wesley Harding was a friend to the poor. He traveled with a gun in every hand. That crawling, itching sensation seemed to increase. It found and centered upon the hole in his left hand. He could have been completely wrong, engaging in wishful thinking and no more, but Thad seemed to sense anger and frustration. All along the telegraph, his name it did resound. Thad sang under his breath. A head lying on the oily ground like the twisted remnant of some steel statue no one had ever really wanted to look at in the first place was a rusty motor mount. Thad picked it up and walked back to the Suburban, still singing snatches of John Wesley Harding under his breath, and remembering his old raccoon buddy of the same name. If he could camouflage the Suburban by beating on it a little, if he could give himself even an extra 2 hours, it could mean the difference between life and death to Liz and the twins. All along the countryside. "Sorry, big guy. This hurts me more than it does you." He opened many a door. He threw the motor mount at the driver's side of the Suburban, bashing a dent as deep as a wash basin in it. He picked up the motor mount again, walked around to the front of the Suburban, and pegged it at the grill hard enough to strain his shoulder. Plastic splintered and flew. Thad unlatched the hood and raised it a little, giving the Suburban the dead alligator smile, which seemed to be the Gold's version of automotive haute couture. But he was never known to hurt an honest man. He picked up the motor mount again, observing as he did so that fresh blood had begun to stain the bandage on his wounded hand. Nothing he could do about it now. With his lady by his side, he took a stand. He threw the mount a final time, sending it through the windshield with a heavy crunch, which, absurd as it might be, pained his heart. He thought the Suburban now looked enough like the other wrecks to pass muster. Thad started walking up the row. He turned right at the first intersection, heading back toward the gate and the retail parts shop beyond it. He had seen a pay telephone on the wall by the door when he drove in. Halfway there, he stopped walking and stopped singing. He cocked his head. He looked like a man straining to catch some small sound. What he was really doing was listening to his body, auditing it. The crawling itch had disappeared. The sparrows were gone, and so was George Stark, at least for the time being. Smiling a little, Thad began to walk faster. 3. After 2 rings, Thad began to sweat. If Raleigh was still there, he should have picked up his phone by now. The faculty offices in the English math building were just not that big. Who else could he call? Who the hell else was there? He could think of no one. Halfway through the 3rd ring, Raleigh picked up his phone. Hello, DeLesseps? Thad closed his eyes at the sound of that smoke-roughened voice and leaned against the cool metal side of the parts shop for a moment. Hello? Hi, Raleigh. It's Thad. Hello, Thad. Raleigh did not seem terribly surprised to hear from him. Forget something? No. Raleigh, I'm in trouble. Yes. Just that, and not a question. Raleigh spoke the word and then just waited. You know those two? Thad hesitated for a moment. Those 2 fellows who were with me? Yes, Raleigh said calmly. The police escort. I ditched them, Thad said, then took a quick glance over his shoulder at the sound of a car rumbling onto the packed dirt which served as Gold's customer parking area. For a moment he was so sure it was the brown Plymouth that he actually saw it. But it was some sort of foreign car. What he had taken at first for brown was a deep red dulled by road dust, and the driver was just turning around. At least I hope I've ditched them. He paused. He had come to the place where the only choice was to jump or not to jump, and he had no time to delay the decision. When you came right down to it, there really wasn't any decision either, because he had no choice. I need help, Raleigh. I need a car they don't know. Raleigh was silent. You said if there was anything you could do for me, I should ask. I'm aware of what I said, Raleigh replied mildly. I also recall saying that if those 2 men were following you around in a protective capacity, you might be wise to give them as much help as you could. He paused. I think I can infer you chose not to take my advice. Thad came very close to saying, I couldn't, Raleigh. The man who has my wife and our babies would only kill them, too. It wasn't that he didn't dare tell Raleigh what was going on, that Raleigh would think he was crazy if he did. College and university professors have much more flexible views on the subject of craziness than most other people, and sometimes they have no view of it at all, preferring to think of people as either dull, but sane, rather eccentric, but sane, or very eccentric, but still quite sane, old boy. He kept his mouth shut, because Raleigh DeLesseps was one of those men so inner-directed that Thad could probably say nothing at all which would persuade him. And anything which came out of his mouth might only damage his case. But, inner-directed or not, the grammarian had a good heart. He was brave in his way, and Thad believed Raleigh was more than a little interested in what was going on with Thad, his police escort, and his odd interest in sparrows. In the end, he simply believed, or only hoped, that it was in his best interest to keep quiet. Still, it was hard to wait. All right, Raleigh said at last. I'll loan you my car, Thad. Thad closed his eyes and had to stiffen his knees to keep them from buckling. He wiped his neck under his chin and his hand came away wet with sweat. But I hope you'll have the decency to stand good for any repairs if it comes back wounded, Raleigh said. If you're a fugitive from justice, I doubt very much if my insurance company will pay. A fugitive from justice? Because he had slipped out from under the gaze of the cops who couldn't possibly protect him? He didn't know if that made him a fugitive from justice or not. It was an interesting question, one he would have to consider at a later date. A later date when he wasn't half out of his mind with worry and fear. You know I would. I have one other condition, Raleigh said. Thad closed his eyes again, this time in frustration. What's that? I want to know all about this when it's over, Raleigh said. I want to know why you were really so interested in the folk meanings of sparrows, and why you turned white when I told you what psychopomps were, and what it is they are supposed to do. Did I turn white? As a sheet. I'll tell you the whole story, Thad promised. He grinned a little. You may even believe some of it.
Where are you?
Raleigh asked. Thad told him and asked him to come as quickly as he could. 4. He hung up the telephone, walked back through the gate and the chain-link fence, and sat down on the wide bumper of a school bus which had, for some reason, been chopped in half. It was a good place to wait, if waiting was what you had to do. He was hidden from the road, but he could see the dirt parking area of the parts department simply by leaning forward. He looked around for sparrows and didn't see a one. Only a large fat crow picking listlessly at shiny bits of chrome in one of the aisles running between the junked cars. The thought that he had finished his second conversation with George Stark only a little over half an hour ago made him feel mildly unreal. It seemed that hours had passed since then. In spite of the steady pitch of anxiety to which he was tuned, he felt sleepy, as if it were bedtime. That itching, crawling sensation began to invade him again about 15 minutes after his conversation with Raleigh. He sang those snatches of John Wesley Harding he still remembered, and after a minute or two, the feeling passed.
Maybe it's psychosomatic, he thought.
But he knew that was bullshit. The feeling was George trying to punch a keyhole into his mind, and as Thad grew more aware of it, he became more sensitive to it. He supposed it would work the other way, too. And he supposed that, sooner or later, he might have to try to make it work the other way. But that meant trying to call the birds, and that wasn't a thing he was looking forward to. And there was something else, too. The last time he'd succeeded in peeking in on George Stark, he'd wound up with a pencil sticking out of his left hand. The minutes crawled by with exquisite slowness. After 25 of them, Thad began to be afraid Raleigh had changed his mind and wasn't coming. He left the bumper of the dismembered bus and stood in the gateway between the automobile graveyard and the parking area, heedless of who might see him from the road. He began to wonder if he dared try hitchhiking. He decided to try Raleigh's office again instead and was halfway to the prefab parts building when a dusty Volkswagen Beetle pulled into the lot. He recognized it at once and broke into a run, thinking with some amusement about Raleigh's insurance concerns. It looked to Thad as if he could total the VW and pay for the damage with a case of returnable soda bottles. Raleigh pulled up beside the end of the parts building and got out. Thad was a little surprised to see that his pipe was lit and giving off great clouds of what would have been extremely offensive smoke in a closed room. "You're not supposed to smoke, Raleigh," was the first thing he could think of to say.
"You're not supposed to run," Raleigh returned gravely.
They looked at each other for a moment and then burst into surprised laughter.
"How will you get home?" Thad asked.
Now that it had come down to this, just jumping into Raleigh's little car and following the long and winding road down to Castle Rock, he seemed to have nothing left in his store of conversation but non sequiturs.
"Call a cab, I imagine," Raleigh said.
He eyed the glittering hills and valleys of junked cars.
"I'd guess they must come out here quite frequently to pick up fellows who are rejoining the great unhorsed."
"Let me give you $5.
Thad pulled his wallet from his back pocket, but Raleigh waved him away.
"I'm loaded for an English teacher in the summertime," he said. "Why, I must have more than $40. It's a wonder Billy lets me walk around without a Brinks guard."
He puffed at his pipe with great pleasure, removed it from his mouth, and smiled at Thad.
"But I'll get a receipt from the cab driver and present it to you at the proper moment, Thad. Never fear."
"I'd started to think that maybe you weren't going to come."
"I stopped at the 5 and 10, Raleigh said. "Picked up a couple of things I thought you might like to have, Thaddeus."
He leaned back into the Beetle, which sagged quite noticeably to the left on a spring which was either broken or would be soon, and after some time spent rummaging, muttering, and puffing out fresh clouds of smog, brought out a paper bag. He handed the bag to Thad, who looked in and saw a pair of sunglasses and a Boston Red Sox baseball cap, which would cover his hair quite nicely. He looked up at Raleigh, absurdly touched.
"Thank you, Raleigh."
Raleigh waved a hand and gave Thad a sly and slanted little smile.
"Maybe I'm the one who should thank you," he said. "I've been looking for an excuse to stoke up the old stinker for the last 10 months. Things would come along from time to time. My youngest son's divorce, the night I lost $50 playing poker at Tom Carroll's house. But nothing seemed quite apocalyptic enough."
"This is apocalyptic, all right," Thad said, and shivered a little.
He looked at his watch. It was pushing 1 o'clock. Stark had at least an hour on him, maybe more. I have to be going, Raleigh.
Yes, it's urgent, isn't it?
I'm afraid so.
I have one other thing. I stuck it in my coat pocket so I wouldn't lose it. This didn't come from the 5 and 10. I found it in my desk.
Raleigh began to rummage methodically through the pockets of the old checked sport coat he wore winter and summer.
If the oil light comes on, swing in someplace and get a jug of sapphire, he said, still hunting. That's the recycled stuff. Oh, here it is. I was starting to think I'd left it back at the office after all.
He took a tubular piece of peeled wood from his pocket. It was about as long as Thad's forefinger and hollow. A notch had been cut in one end. It looked old.
What is it?
Thad asked, taking it when Raleigh held it out. But he already knew, and he felt another block of whatever unthinkable thing it was that he was building slide into place.
It's a bird call,
Raleigh said, studying him from above the shimmering bowl of his pipe.
If you think you can use it, I want you to take it.
Thank you, Thad said, and put the bird call into his breast pocket with a hand which was not quite steady.
It might come in handy.
Raleigh's eyes widened beneath the tangled hedge of his brows. He took the pipe from his mouth.
I'm not sure you'll need it, he said, in a low, unsteady voice.
What?
Look behind you.
Thad turned, knowing what Raleigh had seen even before he saw it himself. There were not hundreds of sparrows now, or thousands. The dead cars and trucks stacked on the back 10 acres of Gold's junkyard and auto supply were carpeted with sparrows. They were everywhere, and Thad had not heard a single one of them come. The two men looked at the birds with four eyes. The birds looked back with 20,000, or perhaps 40,000. They did not make a sound. They only sat on hoods, windows, roofs, exhaust pipes, grills, engine blocks, universal joints and frames.
Jesus Christ, Raleigh said hoarsely. The cycle pumps. What does it mean, Thad? What does it mean?
I think I'm just starting to know, Thad said.
My God, Raleigh said.
He lifted his hands above his head and clapped them loudly. The sparrows did not move, and they had no interest in Raleigh. It was only Thad Beaumont they were looking at.
Find George Stark,
Thad said in a quiet voice, really not much more than a whisper.
George Stark. Find him. Fly.
The sparrows rose into the hazy blue sky in a black cloud, wings whirring with a sound that was like thunder turned to thinnest lace, throats cheeping. Two men who had been standing just inside the doorway of the retail parts shop ran out to look. Overhead, the single black mass banked and turned as the other, smaller flock had done, and headed west. Thad looked up at them, and for a moment this reality merged with the vision which marked the onset of his trances. For a moment past and present were one, entwined in some strange and gorgeous pigtail. The sparrows were gone.
Christ almighty, a man in a gray mechanic's coverall was bellowing. Did you see those birds? Where'd all those fucking birds come from? I have a better question,
Raleigh said, looking at Thad. He was in control of himself again, but it was clear he had been badly shaken.
Where are they going? You know, don't you, Thad?
Yes, of course, Thad muttered, opening the VW's door. I have to go too, Raleigh.
I really have to.
I can't thank you enough.
Be careful, Thaddeus. Be very careful. No man controls the agents of the afterlife. Not for long. And there is always a price.
I'll be as careful as I can. The VW stick shift protested, but finally gave up and went into gear. Thad paused long enough to put on the dark glasses and the baseball cap, then raised his hand to Raleigh and pulled out. As he turned onto Route 2, he saw Raleigh trudging toward the same pay telephone he had used himself, and Thad thought,
Now I've got to keep Stark out, because now I have a secret. I may not be able to control the psychopomps, but for a little while at least I own them. Or they own me. And he must not know that.
He found second gear, and Raleigh de Lesseps' Volkswagen began to shutter itself into the largely unexplored realms of speed above 35 miles an hour. Chapter 23. Two calls for Sheriff Pangborn. 1. The first two calls which sent Alan Pangborn back into the heart of the thing came just after 3 o'clock, while Thad was pouring 3 quarts of Sapphire motor oil into Raleigh's thirsty Volkswagen at an Augusta service station. Alan himself was on his way to Nan's for a cup of coffee. Sheila Brigham poked her head out of the dispatcher's office and yelled, "Alan, collect call for you. Do you know somebody named Hugh Pritchard?" Alan swung back. "Yes, take the call." He hurried into his office and picked up the phone just in time to hear Sheila accepting the charges. Dr. Pritchard, are you there?" "Yes, right here." The connection was a pretty good one, but Alan still had a moment of doubt. This man didn't sound 70. 40, maybe, but not 70. "Are you the Dr. Hugh Pritchard who used to practice in Bergenfield, New Jersey?" "Bergenfield, Tenafly, Hackensack, Englewood, Englewood Heights. Hell, I doctored heads all the way to Patterson. Are you the Sheriff Pangborn who's been trying to get hold of me? My wife and I were way the hell and gone over to Devil's Knob. Just got back. Even my aches have aches." "Yes, I'm sorry. I want to thank you for calling, Doctor. You sound much younger than I expected." "Well, that's fine," Pritchard said. "But you should see the rest of me. I look like an alligator walking on 2 legs. What can I do for you?" Alan had considered this and decided on a careful approach. Now he cocked the telephone between his ear and his shoulder, leaned back in his chair, and the parade of shadow animals commenced on the wall. "I'm investigating a murder here in Castle County, Maine," he said. "The victim was a local man named Homer Gamache. There may be a witness to the crime, but I am in a very delicate situation with this man, Dr. Pritchard. There are 2 reasons why. First, he's famous. Second, he's exhibiting symptoms with which you were once familiar. I say so because you operated on him 28 years ago. He had a brain tumor. I'm afraid that if this tumor has recurred, his testimony may not be very Thaddeus Beaumont," Pritchard interrupted at once. "And whatever symptoms he may be suffering, I doubt very much if it's a recurrence of that old tumor." "How did you know it was Beaumont?" "Because I saved his life back in 1960, Pritchard said, and added with an unconscious arrogance, "If not for me, he wouldn't have written a single book, because he would have been dead before his 12th birthday. I followed his career with some interest ever since he almost won that National Book Award for his first novel. I took one look at the photograph on the jacket and knew it was the same guy. The face had changed, but the eyes were the same. Unusual eyes. Dreamy, I should have called them. And, of course, I knew that he lived in Maine because of the recent article in People. It came out just before we went on vacation." He paused for a moment and then said something so stunning and yet so casual that Alan could not respond for a moment. "You say he may have witnessed a murder? You sure you don't really suspect he may have committed one?" "Well, I only wonder," Pritchard went on, "because people with brain tumors often do very peculiar things. The peculiarity of the act seems to rise in direct ratio to the intelligence of the man or woman so afflicted. But the boy didn't have a brain tumor at all, you know. At least, not in the usually accepted sense of the term. It was an unusual case. Extremely unusual. I've read of only 3 similar cases since 1960. 2 of them since I retired." "Has he had the standard neurological tests?"
"Yes."
"And?" "They were negative." "I'm not surprised." Pritchard fell silent for a few moments, then said, "You're being less than honest with me, young man, aren't you?" Alan stopped making shadow animals and sat forward in his chair.
"Yes, I suppose I am. But I very badly want to know what you mean when you say Thad Beaumont didn't have a brain tumor in the usually accepted sense of the term. I know all about the confidentiality rule in doctor-patient relationships, and I don't know if you can trust a man you're talking to for the first time, and over the phone at that. But I hope you'll believe me when I say that I'm on Thad's side here, and I'm sure he would want you to tell me what I want to know. And I can't take the time to have him call you and give you the go-ahead, Doctor. I need to know now." And Alan was surprised to find that this was true, or he believed it to be true. A funny tenseness had begun to creep over him, a feeling that things were happening, things he didn't know about, but soon would.
I have no problem with telling you about the case, Pritchard said calmly. I have thought on many occasions that I ought to get in touch with Beaumont myself, if only to tell him what happened at the hospital shortly after his surgery was complete. I felt it might interest him.
What was that?
I'll get to it, I assure you. I didn't tell his parents what the operation had uncovered because it didn't matter, not in any practical way, and I didn't want anything more to do with him, with his father in particular. That man should have been born in a cave and spent his life hunting woolly mammoths. I decided at the time to tell them what they wanted to hear and get shut of them as fast as I could. Then, of course, time itself became a factor. You lose touch with your patients. I thought of writing to him when Helga showed me that first book, and I've thought of it on several occasions since then. But I also felt he might not believe me, or wouldn't care, or that he might think I was a crackpot. I don't know any famous people, but I pity them. I suspect they must live defensive, disorganized, fearful lives. It seemed easier to let sleeping dogs lie. Now this, as my grandchildren would say, it's a bummer.
What was wrong with Thad? What brought him to you?
Fugues, headaches, phantom sounds, and finally...
Phantom sounds?
Yes, but you must let me tell it my own way, Sheriff. Again, Alan heard that unconscious arrogance in the man's voice.
All right.
Finally, there was a seizure. The problems were all being caused by a small mass in the prefrontal lobe. We operated, assuming it was a tumor. The tumor turned out to be Thad Beaumont's twin.
What?
Yes, indeed, Pritchard said. He sounded as if the unalloyed shock in Alan's voice rather pleased him. This is not entirely uncommon. Twins are often absorbed in utero, and in rare cases the absorption is incomplete. But the location was unusual, and so was the growth spurt of the foreign tissue. Such tissue almost always remains inert. I believe that Thad's problems may have been caused by the early onset of puberty.
Wait, Alan said, just wait.
He had read the phrase, his mind reeled, a time or two in books, but this was the first time he had ever experienced such a feeling himself.
Are you telling me that Thad was a twin, but he somehow ate his brother?
Or sister, Pritchard said. But I suspect it was a brother, because I believe absorption is much more rare in cases of fraternal twins. That's based on statistical frequency, not hard fact. But I do believe it. And since identicals are always the same sex, the answer to your question is yes. I believe the fetus Thad Beaumont once was ate his brother in his mother's womb.
Jesus, Alan said in a low voice.
He could not remember hearing anything so horrible or so alien in his entire life. You sound revolted, Dr. Pritchard said cheerfully. But there is really no need to be once you put the matter in its proper context. We're not talking about Cain rising up and slaying Abel with a rock. This was not an act of murder. It's just that some biological imperative we don't understand went to work here. A bad signal, perhaps, triggered by something in the mother's endocrine system. We aren't even talking about fetuses, if we speak exactly. At the time of absorption, there would have been two conglomerates of tissue in Mrs. Beaumont's womb. Probably not even humanoid. Living amphibians, if you will. And one of them, the larger, the stronger, simply swarmed over the weaker and folded it and incorporated it.
It sounds fucking insectile, Alan muttered.
Does it? I suppose so, a little. At any rate, the absorption was not complete. A little of the other twin retained its integrity. This alien matter, I can think of no other way to put it, wound up entwined in the tissue which became Thaddeus Beaumont's brain. And for some reason, it became active not long after the boy turned 11. It began to grow. There was no room at the inn. Therefore, it was necessary to excise it like a wart, which we did very successfully.
Like a wart,
Alan said, sickened, fascinated. All sorts of ideas were flying in his mind. They were dark ideas, as dark as bats in a deserted church steeple. Only one was completely coherent.
He is two men. He has always been two men. That's what any man or woman who makes believe for a living must be. The one who exists in the normal world, and the one who creates worlds. They are two. Always at least two.
I would remember such an unusual case no matter what, Pritchard was saying. But something happened just before the boy woke up that was perhaps even more unusual. Something I have always wondered about.
What was it?
The Beaumont boy heard birds before each of his headaches, Pritchard said. That in itself was not unusual. It's a well-documented occurrence in cases of brain tumor or epilepsy. It is called sensory precursor syndrome. But shortly after the operation, there was an odd incident concerning real birds. Bergenfield County Hospital was, in fact, attacked by sparrows.
What do you mean?
It sounds absurd, doesn't it? Pritchard seemed quite pleased with himself. It isn't the kind of thing I'd even talk about, except that it was an extremely well-documented event. There was even a story about it on the front page of the Bergenfield Courier, with a picture. At just past 2 p.m. on October 28, 1960, an extremely large flock of sparrows flew into the west side of County Hospital. That is the side where the intensive care unit was in those days, and of course that was where the Beaumont boy was taken following his operation. A great many windows were broken, and the maintenance men cleared away better than 300 dead birds following the incident. An ornithologist was quoted in the Courier's article, as I recall. He pointed out that the west side of the building was almost wholly glass and theorized that the birds might have been attracted by the bright sunlight reflected on that glass.
That's crazy, Allen said. Birds only fly into glass when they can't see it.
I believe the reporter conducting the interview mentioned that, and the ornithologist pointed out that flocking birds seem to share a group telepathy which unites their many minds, if birds can be said to have minds, into one. Rather like foraging ants. He said that if one of the flock decided to fly into the glass, the rest probably just followed along. I wasn't at the hospital when it happened. I'd finished with the Beaumont boy, checked to make sure his vitals were stable.
Vitals?
Vital signs, Sheriff. Then I left to play golf. But I understand that those birds scared the bejabbers out of everyone in the Hirschfield wing. 2 people were cut by flying glass. I could accept the ornithologist's theory, but it still made a ripple in my mind, because I knew about young Beaumont's sensory precursor, you see. Not just birds, but specific birds. Sparrows.
The sparrows are flying again, Allen muttered in a distracted, horrified voice.
I beg your pardon, Sheriff?
Nothing. Go on.
I questioned him about his symptoms a day later. Sometimes there is localized amnesia about sensory precursors following an operation which removes the cause, but not in this case. He remembered perfectly well. He saw the birds as well as heard them. Birds everywhere, he said, all over the houses and lawns and streets of Ridgeway, which was the section of Bergenfield where he lived. I was interested enough to check his charts and match them with the reports of the incident. The flock of sparrows hit the hospital at about 2:05. The boy woke up at 2:10, maybe even a little earlier. Pritchard paused and then added, In fact, one of the ICU nurses said she believed it was the sound of the breaking glass that woke him up.
Wow, Allen said softly.
Yes, Pritchard said, wow is right. I haven't spoken of that business in years, Sheriff Pangborn. Does any of it help?
I don't know, Allen said honestly. It might. Dr. Pritchard, maybe you didn't get it all. I mean, if you didn't, maybe it started growing again.
You said he'd had tests. Was one of them a CAT scan?
Yes.
And he was X-rayed, of course.
Uh-huh.
If those tests showed negative, then it's because there's nothing to show. For my part, I believe we did get it all.
Thank you, Dr. Pritchard.
He had a little trouble forming the words. His lips felt numb and strange. Will you tell me what has happened in greater detail when this matter has resolved itself, Sheriff? I've been very frank with you, and it seems a small favor to ask in return. I'm very curious.
I will if I can.
That's all I ask. I will let you get back to your job, and I will return to my vacation.
I hope you and your wife are having a good time.
Pritchard sighed. At my age, I have to work harder and harder to have just a mediocre time, Sheriff. We used to love camping. But I think next year we'll stay home.
Well, I sure appreciate you taking the time to return my call.
It was my pleasure. I miss my work, Sheriff Pangborn. Not the mystique of surgery. I never cared much for that. But the mystery. The mystery of the mind. That was very exciting.
I imagine it was, Alan agreed, thinking he would be very happy if there were a little less mental mystery in his life right now. I'll be in touch if and when things clarify themselves. Thank you, Sheriff. He paused and then said, This is a matter of great concern to you, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
The boy, I remember, was very pleasant. Scared, but pleasant. What sort of man is he?
A good one, I think, Alan said. A trifle cold, maybe, and a trifle distant, but a good man for all that.
And he repeated, I think. Thank you. I'll let you get on with your business. Goodbye, Sheriff Pangborn. There was a click on the line, and Alan replaced the receiver slowly. He leaned back in his chair, folded his limber hands, and made a large blackbird flap slowly across the patch of sun on his office wall. A line from The Wizard of Oz occurred to him and went clanging around in his mind. I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks. That had been the Cowardly Lion, hadn't it? The question was, what did he believe? It was easier for him to think of things he didn't believe. He didn't believe Thad Beaumont had murdered anybody, nor did he believe Thad had written that cryptic sentence on anyone's wall. So how had it gotten there? Simple. Old Dr. Pritchard just flew east from Fort Laramie, killed Frederick Clausen, wrote "The Sparrows Are Flying Again" on his wall, then flew on up to New York from D.C., picked Miriam Cowley's lock with his favorite scalpel, and did the same thing to her. He operated on them because he missed the mystery of surgery. No, of course not. But Pritchard wasn't the only one who knew about Thad's, what had he called it? His sensory precursor. It hadn't been in the People article, true, but... You're forgetting the fingerprints and the voice prints. You're forgetting Thad's and Liz's calm, flat assertion that George Stark is real. That he's willing to commit murder in order to stay real. And now you're trying like hell not to examine the fact that you are starting to believe it all might be true. You talk to them about how crazy it would be to believe not just in a vengeful ghost, but in the ghost of a man who never was. But writers invite ghosts, maybe. Along with actors and artists, they are the only totally accepted mediums of our society. They make worlds that never were, populate them with people who never existed, and then invite us to join them in their fantasies. And we do it, don't we? Yes. We pay to do it. Alan knotted his hands tightly, extended his pinky fingers, and sent a much smaller bird flying across the sunny wall. A sparrow. You can't explain the flock of sparrows that hit Bergenfield County Hospital almost 30 years ago any more than you can explain how two men can have the same fingerprints and voice prints. But now you know that Thad Beaumont shared his mother's womb with someone else. With a stranger. Hugh Pritchard had mentioned the early onset of puberty. Alan Pangborn suddenly found himself wondering if the growth of that alien tissue coincided with something else. He wondered if it had begun to grow at the same time Thad Beaumont began to write. 2. The intercom on his desk beeped, startling him. It was Sheila again.
Fuzzy Martin's on line one, Alan. He wants to talk to you.
Fuzzy? What in hell's name does he want?
I don't know. He wouldn't tell me.
Jesus, Alan said. That's all I need today.
Fuzzy had a large chunk of property out on Town Road Number 2, about 4 miles from Castle Lake. The Martin place had once been a prosperous dairy farm, but that had been in the days when Fuzzy had been known by his proper Christian name, Albert, and was still holding the whiskey jug instead of the other way around. His kids were grown, his wife had given him up as a bad job 10 years ago, and now Fuzzy presided alone over 27 acres of fields which were going slowly but steadily back to the wild. On the west side of his property, where Town Road Number 2 wound by on its way to the lake, the house and barn stood. The barn, which had once been home to 40 cows, was a huge building, its roof now deeply sway-backed, its paint peeling, most of the windows blocked with squares of cardboard. Alan and Trevor Hartland, the Castle Rock fire chief, had been waiting for the Martin house, the Martin barn, or the Martin both to burn down for the last 4 years or so.
Do you want me to tell him you're not here? Sheila asked. Clut just came in. I could give it to him.
Alan actually considered this for a moment, then sighed and shook his head.
I'll talk to him, Sheila. Thanks. He picked up the telephone and cocked it between his ear and his shoulder.
Chief Pangborn?
This is the sheriff, yes.
This is Fuzzy Martin, out on number 2. Might have a problem out here, Chief.
Oh? Alan drew the second telephone on the desk closer to him. This was a direct line to the other offices in the municipal building. The tip of his finger skated around the square keypad with the number 4 stamped on it. All he had to do was pick up the receiver and push the button to get Trevor Hartland.
What kind of problem is that?
Well, Chief, I'll be dipped in shit if I exactly know. I'd call it grand car thievery if it was a car I knew. But 'twasn't. Never seen it before in my life. But it came out of my barn just the same.
Fuzzy spoke with that deep and somehow satiric Maine accent that turned a simple word like barn into something that sounded almost like a bray of laughter. Barn. Alan pushed the interoffice telephone back to its normal place. God favored fools and drunks, a fact he had learned well in his many years of police work, and it seemed that Fuzzy's house and barn were still standing in spite of his habit of flicking live cigarette butts here, there, and everywhere while he was drunk. Now all I have to do, Alan thought, is sit here until he unravels whatever the problem is. Then I can figure out, or try to, if it's in the real world or only inside whatever is left of Fuzzy's mind. He caught his hands flying another sparrow across the wall and made them stop.
What car was it that came out of your barn, Albert?
Alan asked patiently. Almost everyone in the Rock, including the man himself, called Albert Fuzzy, and Alan might try it himself after he'd been in town another 10 years. Or maybe 20.
Just told you I never seen it before,
Fuzzy Martin said, in a tone that said, oh, you damned fool, so clearly he might as well have spoken it.
That's why I'm calling you, Chief. Sure wasn't one of mine.
A picture at last began to form in Alan's mind. With his cows, his kids, and his wife gone, Fuzzy Martin didn't need a whole lot of hard cash. The land had been his free and clear, except for taxes, when he inherited it from his dad. What money Fuzzy did see came from various odd sources. Alan believed, almost knew, in fact, that a bale or two of marijuana joined the hay in Fuzzy's barn loft every couple of months or so. And that was just one of Fuzzy's little scams. He had thought from time to time that he ought to make a serious effort to bust Fuzzy for possession with intent to sell, but he doubted if Fuzzy even smoked the stuff, let alone had brains enough to sell it. Most likely he just collected $100 or $200 every now and again for providing storage space. And even in a little burg like Castle Rock, there were more important things to do than busting drunks for holding weed. Another of Fuzzy's storage services, this illegal one at least, was keeping cars in his barn for summer people. When Alan first came to town, Fuzzy's barn had been a regular parking garage. You could go in there and see as many as 15 cars, most of them summer cars owned by people who had places on the lake, stored where the cows used to spend their winters. Fuzzy had knocked out the partitions to make one big garage, and there the summer cars waited out the long months of fall and winter in the sweet hay-smelling shadows, their bright surfaces dulled by the steady fall of old chaff from the loft, parked bumper to bumper and side to side. Over the years, Fuzzy's car storage business had fallen off radically. Alan supposed that word of his careless smoking habits had gotten around and that had done it. No one wants to lose their car in a barn fire, even if it's just an old lag you kept around to run errands when summer came. The last time he had been out to Fuzzy's, Alan had seen only 2 cars in the barn. Ossie Brannigan's 59 T-Bird, a car which would have been a classic if it hadn't been so rusted out and beat to shit, and Thad Beaumont's old Ford Woody wagon. Thad again. Today it seemed that all roads led back to Thad Beaumont. Alan sat up straighter in his chair, unconsciously pulling the telephone closer to him.
It wasn't Thad Beaumont's old Ford, he asked Fuzzy now. You're sure?
Course I'm sure. This wasn't no Ford, and it sure as hell wasn't any Woody wagon. It was a black Toronado.
Another flare went off in Alan's mind, but he wasn't quite sure why. Someone had said something to him about a black Toronado, and not long ago. He couldn't think just who or when, not now. But it would come to him.
I just happened to be in the kitchen getting myself a cool drink of lemonade, Fuzzy was going on, when I seen that car backing out of the barn. First thing I thought of was how I don't store no car like that. Second thing I thought of was how anybody got it in there in the first place, when there's a big old Krieg padlock on the barn door, and I got the only key to it on my ring.
What about the people with cars stored in there? They don't have keys?
No, sir. Fuzzy seemed offended by the very idea.
You didn't happen to get the license plate number, did you?
You're damn tootin' I got it, Fuzzy cried. Got the goddamn old Jeasley binoculars right there on the kitchen windowsill, ain't I?
Alan, who had been in the barn on inspection tours with Trevor Hartland, but never in Fuzzy's kitchen, and had no plans to make such a trip soon, thanks, said,
Oh, yeah, the binoculars. I forgot about them.
Well, I didn't, Fuzzy said with happy truculence. You got a pencil?
I sure do, Albert.
Chief, why don't you just call me Fuzzy like everyone else?
Alan sighed. Okay, Fuzzy. And while we're at it, why don't you just call me Sheriff?
Whatever you say. Now, do you want this plate number or not?
Shoot.
First off, it was a Mississippi plate,
Fuzzy said with something like triumph in his voice.
What the hell do you think of that?
Alan didn't know exactly what he thought of it, except a third flare had gone off in his head, this one even brighter than the others.
A tornado and Mississippi. Something about Mississippi and a town.
Oxford? Was it Oxford?
Like the one two towns over from here?
I don't know, Alan said, and then, supposing it was the thing Fuzzy wanted to hear, it sounds pretty suspicious.
Ain't you Christing right? Fuzzy crowed.
Then he cleared his throat and became businesslike.
Okay. Mississippi plate 62284. You got that, Chief?
62284.
62284, are ya? You can take that to the fucking bank. Suspicious. Oh, yeah? That's just what I thought. Jesus ate a can of beans.
At the image of Jesus chowing down on a can of B&M beans, Alan had to cover the telephone for another brief moment.
So, Fuzzy said, what action you gonna take, Chief?
I am going to try and get out of this conversation with my sanity intact, Alan thought. That's the first thing I'm going to do, and I'm going to try and remember who mentioned.
Then it came to him in a flash of cold radiance that made his arms crown with goose flesh and stretched the flesh on the back of his neck as tight as a drumhead.
On the phone with Thad, not long after the psycho called from Miriam Cowley's apartment, the night the killing spree had really started. He heard Thad saying, he moved from New Hampshire to Oxford, Mississippi with his mother. He's lost all but a trace of his southern accent.
What else had Thad said when he had been describing George Stark over the telephone?
Final thing. He may be driving a black Toronado. I don't know what year. One of the old ones with a lot of blasting powder under the hood, anyway. Black. It could have Mississippi plates, but he's undoubtedly switched them.
I guess he was a little too busy to do that, Alan muttered. The goose flesh was still crawling over his body with its thousand tiny feet.
What was that, Chief?
Nothing, Albert. Talking to myself.
My mom used to say that meant you was going to get some money. Maybe I ought to start doing it myself.
Alan suddenly remembered that Thad had added something else. One final detail.
Albert.
Call me Fuzzy, Chief. Told you.
Fuzzy, was there a bumper sticker on the car you saw? Did you maybe notice?
How the hell did you know about that? You got a hot sheet on that motor, Chief?
Fuzzy asked eagerly.
Never mind the questions, Fuzzy. This is police business. Did you see what it said?
Of course I did, Fuzzy Martin said. High-toned son of a bitch, that's what it said. Can you believe that?
Alan hung up the phone slowly, believing it, but telling himself it proved nothing, nothing at all. Except that maybe Thad Beaumont was as crazy as a bedbug. It would just be plain stupid to think that what Fuzzy had seen proved anything. Well, anything supernatural, for want of a better word, was going on. Then he thought of the voice prints and the fingerprints. He thought of hundreds of sparrows crashing into the windows of Bergenfield County Hospital, and he was overcome with a fit of violent shivering that lasted almost a full minute. 3.
Alan Pangborn was neither a coward nor a superstitious countryman who forked the sign of the evil eye at crows and kept his pregnant womenfolk away from the fresh milk because he was afraid they would clatter it. He was not a rube. He was not susceptible to the blandishments of city slickers who wanted to sell famous bridges cheap. He had not been born yesterday. He believed in logic and reasonable explanations. So he waited out his flock of shivers, and then he pulled his Rolodex over in front of him and found Thad's telephone number. He observed with wry amusement that the number on the card and the one in his head matched. Apparently Castle Rock's distinguished writer fella had remained even more firmly fixed in his mind, some part of it anyway, than he had thought. It has to have been Thad in that car. If you eliminate the nutty stuff, what other alternative is there? He described it. What was the old radio quiz show? Name it and claim it. Bergenfield County Hospital was, in fact, attacked by sparrows. And there were other questions. Far too many. Thad and his family were under protection from the Maine State Police. If they had decided to pack up and come down here for the weekend, the state boys should have given him a call, partially to alert him, partially as a gesture of courtesy. But the state police would have tried to dissuade Thad from making such a trip, now that they had their protective surveillance down to routine up there in Ludlow. And if the trip had been of the spur-of-the-moment kind, their efforts to change his mind would have been even more strenuous. Then there was what Fuzzy had not seen, namely the backup car, or cars that would have been assigned the Beaumonts if they decided to put on their traveling shoes anyway, as they could have done. They weren't, after all, prisoners. People with brain tumors often do very peculiar things. If it was Thad's Toronado, and if he had been out at Fuzzy's to get it, and if he had been alone, that led to a conclusion Alan found very unpalatable, because he had taken a qualified liking to Thad. That conclusion was that he had deliberately ditched both his family and his protectors. The state police should have called me, if that was the case. They'd put out an APB, and they'd know damned well this is one of the places he'd be likely to come. He dialed the Beaumont number. It was picked up on the first ring. A voice he didn't know answered, which was only to say he could not put a name to the voice. That he was speaking to an officer of the law was something he knew from the first syllable. Hello, Beaumont residence. Guarded, ready to drive a wedge of questions into the next gap if the voice happened to be the right one or the wrong one. What's happened? Pangborn wondered. And on the heels of that, they're dead. Whoever's out there has killed the whole family as quickly, effortlessly, and with as little mercy as he showed the others. The protection, the interrogations, the traceback equipment, it was all for nothing. Not even a hint of these thoughts showed in his voice as he answered. This is Alan Pangborn, he said crisply. Sheriff, Castle County. I was calling for Thad Beaumont. To whom am I speaking? There was a pause. Then the voice replied, This is Steve Harrison, Sheriff. Maine State Police. I was going to call you. Should have done it at least an hour ago. But things here are fucked all the way to the ionosphere. Can I ask why you called? Without a pause for thought, that would certainly have changed his response, Alan lied. He did it without asking himself why he was doing it. That would come later. I called to check in with Thad, he said. It's been a while, and I wanted to know how they're doing. I gather there's been trouble. Trouble so big you wouldn't believe it, Harrison said grimly. Two of my men are dead. We're pretty sure Beaumont did it. We're pretty sure Beaumont did it. The peculiarity of the acts seems to rise in direct ratio to the intelligence of the man or woman so afflicted. Alan felt deja vu, not just stealing into his mind, but marching over his whole body like an invading army. Thad. It always came back to Thad. Of course. He was intelligent, he was peculiar, and he was, by his own admission, suffering from symptoms which suggested a brain tumor. The boy didn't have a brain tumor at all, you know. If those tests showed negative, then it's because there's nothing to show. Forget the tumor. The sparrows are what you want to be thinking about now, because the sparrows are flying again. What happened? He asked Trooper Harrison. He cut Tom Chatterton and Jack Eddings damn near to pieces. That's what happened, Harrison shouted, startling Alan with the depth of his fury.
He's got his family with him, and I want that son of a bitch.
What? How did he get away?
I don't have the time to go into it, Harrison said. It's a sorry fucking story, Sheriff. He was driving a red and gray Chevrolet Suburban, a goddamn whale on wheels. But we think he must have ditched it someplace and switched. He's got a summer place down there. You know the locale and the layout, right?
Yes, Alan said. His mind was racing. He looked at the clock on the wall and saw it was a minute or so shy of 3:40.
Time. It all came back to time.
And he realized he hadn't asked Fuzzy Martin what time it had been when he saw the Toronado rolling out of his barn. It hadn't seemed important at the moment. Now it did.
What time did you lose him, Trooper Harrison?
He thought he could feel Harrison fuming at that, but when he answered, he did so without anger or defensiveness.
Around 12:30. He must have taken a while to switch cars, if that's what he did, and then he went to his house in Ludlow.
Where was he when you lost him? How far away from his house?
Sheriff, I'd like to answer all your questions, but there's no time. The point is, if he's headed for his place down there, it seems unlikely, but the guy's crazy, so you never know. He won't have arrived yet, but he'll be there soon. Him and his whole fam-damily. It would be very nice if you and a couple of your men were there to greet him. If something pops, you radio Henry Payton at the Oxford State Police Barracks, and we'll send more backup than you've ever seen in your life. Don't try to apprehend him yourself under any circumstances. We're assuming the wife's been taken hostage, if she's not dead already. And that goes double for the kids.
Yes, he'd have to have taken his wife by force if he killed the troopers on duty, wouldn't he? Alan agreed, and found himself thinking,
but you'd make them part of it if you could, wouldn't you? Because your mind is made up and you're not going to change it. Hell, man, you're not even going to think straight or otherwise until the blood dries on your friends.
There were a dozen questions he wanted to ask, and the answers to those would probably produce another 4 dozen. But Harrison was right about one thing. There wasn't time. He hesitated for a moment, wanting very badly to ask Harrison about the most important thing of all, wanting to ask the jackpot question. Was Harrison sure Thad had had time to get to his house, kill the man on guard there, and spirit his family away, all before the first reinforcements arrived? But to ask the question would be to claw at the painful wound this Harrison was trying to deal with right now, because buried in the question was that condemning, irrefutable judgment. You lost him. Somehow you lost him. You had a job to do and you fucked it up.
Can I depend on you, Sheriff? Harrison asked, and now his voice didn't sound angry, only tired and harried, and Alan's heart went out to him.
Yes, I'll have the place covered almost immediately.
Good man. And you'll liaise with the Oxford Barracks?
Affirmative. Henry Payton's a friend.
Beaumont is dangerous, Sheriff. Extremely dangerous. If he does show up, you watch your ass.
I will.
And keep me informed.
Harrison broke the connection without saying goodbye.
4.
His mind, the part of it that busied itself with protocol anyway, awoke and started asking questions, or trying to. Alan decided he didn't have time for protocol, not in any of its forms. He was simply going to keep all possible circuits open and proceed. He had a feeling things had reached the point where some of those circuits would soon begin to close of their own accord.
At least call some of your own men.
But he didn't think he was ready to do that either. Norris Ridgwick, the one he would have called, was off duty and out of town. John LaPointe was still laid up with poison ivy. Seat Thomas was out on patrol. Andy Clutterbuck was here, but Clut was a rookie, and this was a nasty piece of work. He would roll this one on his own for a while.
You're crazy,
protocol screamed in his mind.
I might be getting there at that,
Alan said out loud. He looked up Albert Martin's number in the phone book and called him back to ask the questions he should have asked the first time.
5.
What time did you see the Toronado backing out of your barn, Fuzzy? He asked when Martin answered and thought,
he won't know. Hell, I'm not entirely sure he knows how to tell time.
But Fuzzy promptly proved him a liar.
Just a cunt's hair, past 3, Chief.
Then after a considering pause,
excuse my franquet.
You didn't call until,
Alan glanced at the day sheet,
where he had logged Fuzzy's call without even thinking about it, until 3:28.
Had to think her over, Fuzzy said. Man should always look before he leaps, Chief. At least that's the way I see her. Before I called you, I went down to the barn to see if whoever got the car was up to any other ructions in there.
Ructions, Alan thought, bemused. Probably checked the bale of pot in the loft while you were at it, didn't you, Fuzzy?
Had he been? Been what?
Up to any other ructions.
Nope, don't believe so.
What condition was the lock in?
Open, Fuzzy said pithily.
Smashed?
Nope, just hanging in the hasp with the arm popped up.
Key, do you think?
Don't know where the son of a whore could have come by one. I think he picked it.
Was he alone in the car? Alan asked. Could you tell that? Fuzzy paused, thinking it over.
I couldn't tell for sure, he said at last. I know what you're thinking, Chief. If I could make out the breed of plate and read that smart-ass sticker, I ought to have been able to make out how many folks was in it. But the sun was on the glass, and I don't think it was ordinary glass either. I think it had some tint to it. Not a whole lot, but some.
Okay, Fuzzy, thanks. We'll check it out.
Well, he's gone from here, Fuzzy said, and then added in a lightning flash of deduction. But he must be somewhere.
That's very true, Alan said.
He promised to tell Fuzzy how it all washed out, then hung up. He pushed away from his desk and looked at the clock.
3, Fuzzy had said. Just a cunt's hair past 3. Excuse my franquet.
Alan didn't think there was any way Thad could have gotten from Ludlow to Castle Rock in 3 hours short of rocket travel. Not with a side trip back to his house thrown in for good measure. A little side trip during which, incidentally, he had kidnapped his wife and kids and killed a couple of state troopers. Maybe if it had been a straight shot right from Ludlow. But to come from someplace else, stop in Ludlow, and then get here in time to pick a lock and drive away in a Toronado he just happened to have conveniently stashed in Fuzzy Martin's barn?
No way. But suppose someone else had killed the troopers at the Beaumont house and snatched Thad's people. Someone who didn't have to mess around losing a police escort, switching vehicles, and making side trips. Someone who had simply piled Liz Beaumont and her twins into a car and headed for Castle Rock. Alan thought they could have gotten here in time for Fuzzy Martin to have seen them at just past 3. They could have done it without even breathing hard. The police, Reed Trooper Harrison, at least for the time being, thought it had to be Thad. But Harrison and his compadres didn't know about the Toronado.
Mississippi plates, Fuzzy had said. Mississippi was George Stark's home state, according to Thad's fictional biography of the man. If Thad was schizo enough to think he was Stark, at least some of the time, he might well have provided himself with a black Toronado to enhance the illusion, or fantasy, or whatever it was. But in order to get plates, he'd not only have to have visited Mississippi, he'd have to claim residency there.
That's dumb. He could have stolen some Mississippi plates, or bought an old set. Fuzzy didn't say anything about what year the tags were. From the house, he probably couldn't have read them anyway, not even with binoculars. But it wasn't Thad's car. Couldn't have been. Liz would have known, wouldn't she?
Maybe not. If he's crazy enough, maybe not.
Then there was the locked door. How could Thad have gotten into the barn without breaking the lock? He was a writer and a teacher, not a cracksman.
Duplicate key, his mind whispered. But Alan didn't think so. If Fuzzy was storing wacky tobacco in there from time to time, Alan thought Fuzzy would be pretty careful of where he left his keys lying around, no matter how careless he was of his cigarette ends. And one final question. The killer. How come Fuzzy had never seen that black Toronado before, if it had been in his barn all along? How could that be?
Try this, a voice in the back of his mind whispered as he grabbed his hat and left the office. This is a pretty funny idea, Alan. You'll laugh. You'll laugh like hell. Suppose Thad Beaumont was right all the way from the jump. Suppose there really is a monster named George Stark running around out there. And the elements of his life, the elements Thad created, come into being when he needs them. When he needs them. But not always where he needs them. because they'd always show up at places connected to the primary creator's life. So Stark would have to get his car out of storage where Thad stores his, just like he had to start from the graveyard where Thad symbolically buried him. Don't you love it? Isn't it a scream? He didn't love it. It wasn't a scream. It wasn't even remotely funny. It drew an ugly scratch, not just across everything he believed, but across the way he had been taught to think. He found himself remembering something Thad had said. "I don't know who I am when I'm writing." That wasn't exact, but it was close. And what's even more amazing, it never occurred to me to wonder until now. "You were him, weren't you?" Alan said softly. "You were him, and he was you, and that's the way the killer grew. Pop goes the weasel." He shivered, and Sheila Brigham looked up from her typewriter at the dispatcher's desk in time to see it. "It's too hot to do that, Alan. You must be coming down with a cold." "Coming down with something, I guess," Alan said. "Cover the telephone, Sheila. Relay anything small to Seat Thomas. Anything big to me. Where's Clut?"
"I'm in here."
Clut's voice came drifting out of the John. "I expect to be back in 45 minutes or so," Alan yelled at him. "You got the desk until I get back."
"Where you going, Alan?"
Clut came out of the men's room, tucking in his khaki shirt. "The lake," Alan said vaguely, and left before either Clut or Sheila could ask any more questions, or before he could reflect on what he was doing. Leaving without a stated destination in a situation like this was a very bad idea. It was asking for more than trouble. It was asking to get killed. But what he was thinking, "The sparrows are flying," simply couldn't be true. Couldn't. There had to be a more reasonable explanation. He was still trying to convince himself of this as he drove his prowl car out of town and into the worst trouble of his life. 6. There was a rest area on Route 5 about a half a mile from Fuzzy Martin's property. Alan turned in, operating on something which was half hunch and half whim. The hunch part was simple enough. Black Toronado or no Black Toronado, they hadn't come down here from Ludlow on a magic carpet. They must have driven, which meant there had to be a ditched car around someplace. The man he was hunting had ditched Homer Gamache's truck in a roadside parking area when he was through with it. And what a perp would do once, he would do again. There were three vehicles parked in the turnaround, a beer truck, a new Ford Escort, and a road-dusty Volvo. As he got out of the prowler car, a man in green fatigues came out of the men's convenience and walked toward the cab of the beer truck. He was short, dark-haired, narrow-shouldered. No George Stark here. "Officer," he said, and gave Alan a little salute. Alan nodded at him and walked down to where three elderly ladies were sitting at one of the picnic tables, drinking coffee from a thermos and talking. "Hello, officer," one of them said. "Can we do something for you?" "Or did we maybe do something wrong?" the momentarily anxious eyes asked. "I just wondered if the Ford and the Volvo up there belonged to you ladies," Alan said. "The Ford is mine," a second said. "We all came in that. I don't know anything about a Volvo." "Is it that sticker thing? Did that sticker thing run out again? My son is supposed to take care of that sticker thing, but he's so forgetful. 43 years old, and I still have to tell him ev—" "The sticker's fine, ma'am," Alan said, smiling his best, the policeman is your friend smile. "None of you happened to see the Volvo drive in, did you?" They shook their heads. "Have you seen anyone else during the last few minutes who might belong to it?" "No," the third lady said. She looked at him with bright little gerbil's eyes. "Are you on the scent, officer?"
"Pardon, ma'am?"
"Tracking a criminal, I mean."
"Oh,"
Alan said. He felt a moment of unreality. Exactly what was he doing here? Exactly what had he been thinking to get here?
"No, ma'am. I just like Volvos."
Boy, that sounded intelligent. That sounded just fucking crackerjack. "Oh," the first lady said. "Well, we haven't seen anyone. Would you like a cup of coffee, officer? I believe there's just about one good one left."
"No, thank you," Alan said. "You ladies have a nice day."
"You too, officer," they chorused in an almost perfect three-part harmony. It made Alan feel more unreal than ever. He walked back up to the Volvo, tried the driver's side door. It opened. The inside of the car had a hot attic feel. It had been sitting here a while. He looked in the back and saw a packet, a little bigger than a sweet and low packet, on the floor. He leaned between the seats and picked it up. "Handy wipe," the packet said, and he felt someone drop a bowling ball in his stomach.
"It doesn't mean anything,"
the voice of protocol and reason spoke up at once.
"At least, not necessarily. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking babies. But, Alan, they give those things out at the roadside stands when you buy fried chicken, for heaven's sake."
"All the same." Alan stuck the handy wipe in one of the pockets of his uniform blouse and got out of the car. He was about to close the door and then leaned in again. He tried to look under the dashboard and couldn't quite do it on his feet. He had to get down on his knees. Someone dropped another bowling ball. He made a muffled sound, the sound of a man who had been hit quite hard. The ignition wires were hanging down, their copper cores bare and slightly kinked. The kink, Alan knew, came from being braided together. The Volvo had been hot-wired, and very efficiently from the look of it. The driver had grasped the wires above the bare cores and pulled them apart again to cut the engine when they had parked here.
So it was true, some of it at least.
The big question was how much? He was beginning to feel like a man edging closer and closer to a potentially lethal drop. He went back to his prowl car, got in, started it up, and took the microphone off its prong.
"What's true?"
Protocol and Reason whispered. God, that was a maddening voice.
"That someone is at the Beaumont's lake house?" "Yes, that might be true. That someone named George Stark backed that black Toronado out of Fuzzy Martin's barn? Come on, Alan."
Two thoughts occurred to him almost simultaneously. The first was that if he contacted Henry Payton at the state police barracks in Oxford, as Harrison had told him to do, he might never know how this came out. Lake Lane, where the Beaumont summer house was located, was a dead end. The state police would tell him not to approach the house on his own, not a single officer, not when they suspected the man who was holding Liz and the twins of at least a dozen murders. They would want him to block off the road, and no more, while they sent out a fleet of cruisers, maybe a chopper, and for all Alan knew, a few destroyers and fighter planes. The second thought was about Stark. They weren't thinking about Stark. They didn't even know about Stark. But what if Stark was real? If that was the case, Alan was coming to believe that sending a bunch of state troopers who didn't know any better up Lake Lane would be like marching men into a meat grinder. He put the microphone back on its prong. He was going in, and he was going in alone. It might be wrong, probably was, but it was what he was going to do. He could live with the thought of his own stupidity. God knew he had done it before. What he couldn't live with was even the possibility that he might have caused the deaths of a woman and two infants by making a radio call for backup before he knew the real nature of the situation. Alan pulled out of the rest area and headed for Lake Lane. Chapter 24. The Coming of the Sparrows. 1. Thad avoided the turnpike on the way down. Stark had instructed Liz to use it, cutting half an hour off their time, and so he had to go through either Lewiston, Auburn, or Oxford. L.A., as the natives called it, was a much bigger metropolitan area, but the state police barracks was in Oxford. He chose Lewiston, Auburn. He was waiting at an Auburn traffic light and checking his rearview mirror constantly for police cars when the idea he'd first grasped clearly while talking to Raleigh at the auto junkyard struck him again. This time it was not just a tickle. It was something like a hard, open-handed blow.
"I am the knower. I am the owner. I am the bringer. It's magic we are dealing with here," Thad thought, "and any magician worth his salt has got to have a magic wand. Everyone knows that. Luckily, I know just where such an item may be had, where, in fact, they sell them by the dozen."
The nearest stationer's store was on Court Street, and now Thad diverted in that direction. He was sure there were barrel Black Beauty pencils at the house in Castle Rock, and he was equally sure Stark had brought his own supply, but he didn't want them. What he wanted were pencils Stark had never touched, either as a part of Thad or as a separate entity. Thad found a parking space half a block down from the stationer's, killed the engine of Raleigh's VW, it died hard with a wheeze and several lunging chugs, and got out. It was good to get away from the ghost of Raleigh's pipe and into the fresh air for a while. At the stationer's, he bought a box of Barrel Black Beauty pencils. The clerk told him to be his guest when Thad asked if he could use the pencil sharpener on the wall. He used it to sharpen six of the barrels. These he put in his breast pocket, lining it from side to side. The lead stuck up like the warheads of small, deadly missiles. Presto and abracadabra, he thought. Let the revels commence. He walked back to Raleigh's car, got in, and just sat there for a moment, sweating in the heat and softly singing John Wesley Harding under his breath. Almost all of the words had come back. It was really amazing what the human mind could do under pressure. This could be very, very dangerous, he thought. He found that he didn't care so much for himself. He had, after all, brought George Stark into the world, and he supposed that made him responsible for him. It didn't seem terribly fair. He didn't think he had created George with any evil intent. He couldn't see himself as either of those infamous doctors, Messrs. Jekyll and Frankenstein, in spite of what might be happening to his wife and children. He had not set out to write a series of novels which would make a great deal of money, and he had certainly not set out to create a monster. He had only been trying to feel a way around the block that had dropped into his path. He had only wanted to find a way to write another good story, because doing that made him happy. Instead, he had caught some sort of supernatural disease. And there were diseases, lots of them, that found homes in the bodies of people who had done nothing to deserve them. Fun things like cerebral palsy, muscular dystrophy, epilepsy, Alzheimer's. But once you got one, you had to deal with it. What was the name of that old radio quiz show? Name It and Claim It? This could be very dangerous for Liz and the kids, though, his mind insisted, reasonably enough. Yes, brain surgery could be dangerous, too. But if you had a tumor growing in there, what choice did you have? He'll be looking, peeking. The pencils are okay. He might even be flattered. But if he senses what you plan to do with him, or if he finds out about the bird call, if he guesses about the sparrows, hell, if he even guesses there's something to guess, then you're in deep shit. But it could work, another part of his mind whispered. God damn it, you know it could work. Yes, he did know it, and because the deepest part of his mind insisted that there was really nothing else to do or try, Thad started the VW and pointed it toward Castle Rock. 15 minutes later, he had left Auburn behind and was out in the country again, heading west toward the Lakes region. 2. For the last 40 miles of the trip, Stark talked steadily about Steel Machine, the book on which he and Thad were going to collaborate. He helped Liz with the kids, always keeping one hand free and close enough to the gun tucked into his belt to keep her convinced, while she unlocked the summer house and let them in. She had been hoping for cars parked in at least some of the driveways leading off Lake Lane, or to hear the sounds of voices or chainsaws. But there had only been the sleepy hum of the insects and the powerful rumble of the Toronado's engine. It seemed that the son of a bitch had the luck of the devil himself. All the time they were unloading and bringing things in, Stark went on talking. He didn't even stop while he was using his straight razor to amputate all but one of the telephone jacks. And the book sounded good. That was the really dreadful thing. The book sounded very good indeed. It sounded as if it might be as big as Machine's Way. Maybe even bigger. I have to go to the bathroom, she said when the luggage was inside, interrupting him in mid-spate. That's fine, he said mildly, turning to look at her. He had taken off the sunglasses once they arrived, and now she had to turn her head aside from him. That glaring, moldering gaze was more than she could deal with. I'll just come along. I like a little privacy when I relieve myself, don't you? It doesn't much matter to me, one way or another, Stark said with serene cheeriness. It was a mood he had been in ever since they left the turnpike at Gates Falls. He had the unmistakable air of a man who now knows things are going to come out all right. But it does to me, she said, as if speaking to a particularly obtuse child. She felt her fingers curling into claws, In her mind, she was suddenly ripping those staring eyeballs out of their slack sockets. And when she risked a glance up at him and saw his amused face, she knew he knew what she was thinking and feeling.
"I'll just stay in the doorway," he said with mock humility. "I'll be a good boy. I won't peek."
The babies were crawling busily around the living room rug. They were cheerful, vocal, full of beans. They seemed to be delighted to be here, where they had been only once before for a long winter weekend. "They can't be left alone," Liz said. "The bathroom is off the master bedroom. If they're left here, they'll get into trouble."
"No problem, Beth,"
Stark said, and scooped them up effortlessly, one under each arm. She would have believed just this morning that if anyone but herself or Thad tried something like that, William and Wendy would have screamed their heads off. But when Stark did it, they giggled merrily, as if this were the most amusing thing under the sun.
"I'll bring them into the bedroom, and I'll be watching them instead of you."
He turned and regarded her with an instant's coldness.
"I'll keep a good eye on them, too. I wouldn't want them to come to any harm, Beth. I like them. If anything happens to them, it won't be my fault."
She went into the bathroom, and he stood in the doorway, his back to her as he had promised, watching the twins. As she raised her skirt and lowered her panties and sat down, she hoped he was a man of his word. She wouldn't die if he turned around and saw her squatting on the john, but if he saw the sewing scissors inside her underwear, she might. And, as usual, when she was in a hurry to go, her bladder hung on obstinately. "Come on, come on," she thought, with a mixture of fear and irritation. "What's the matter? Do you think you're going to collect interest on that stuff?" At last, relief.
"But when they try to come out of the barn," Stark was saying, "machine lights the gasoline they poured into the trench around it in the night. Won't that be great? There's a movie in it too, Beth. The assholes who make the movies love fires."
She used the toilet paper and pulled her panties up very carefully. She kept her eyes glued to Stark's back as she adjusted her clothes, praying that he would not turn around. He didn't. He was deeply absorbed in his own story.
"Westerman and Jack Rangeley ducked back inside, planning to use the car to drive right through the fire. But Ellington panics and..."
He broke off suddenly, his head cocked to one side. Then he turned to her just as she was straightening her skirt.
"Out," he said abruptly, and all the good humor had left his voice. "Get the fuck out of there right now."
"What?" He grabbed her arm with rough force and yanked her into the bedroom. He went into the bathroom and opened the medicine cabinet.
"We've got company, and it's too early for Thad."
"I don't..."
"Car engine," he said briefly. "Powerful motor. Could be a police interceptor. Hear it?"
Stark slammed the medicine cabinet shut and jerked open the drawer to the right of the washstand. He found a roll of Red Cross adhesive tape and popped the tin ring off the donut. She heard nothing and said so.
"That's okay," he said. "I can hear it for both of us. Hands behind you."
"What are you going to..."
"Shut up and put your hands behind you."
She did, and immediately her wrists were bound. He crisscrossed the tape back and forth, in tight figure eights.
"Engine just quit," he said. "Maybe a quarter of a mile up the road. Someone trying to be cute."
She thought she might have heard an engine in the last moment, but it could have been nothing but suggestion. She knew she would have heard nothing at all if she had not been listening with all of her concentration.
Dear God, how sharp were his ears. "Gotta cut this tape," he said. "Pardon me for getting personal for a second or so, Beth. Time's a little short for politeness."
And before she even knew he was doing it, he had reached down the front of her skirt. A moment later, he pulled the sewing scissors free. He didn't even prick her skin with the pins. He glanced in her eyes for just a moment as he reached behind her and used the scissors to cut the tape. He seemed amused again.
"You saw them," she said dully. "You saw the bulge after all." "The scissors?" he laughed. "I saw them, but not the bulge. I saw them in your eyes, darling Bethy. I saw them back in Ludlow. I knew they were there the minute you came downstairs."
He knelt in front of her with the tape, absurdly and ominously, like a suitor proposing marriage. Then he looked up at her.
"Don't you get ideas about kicking me or anything, Beth. I don't know for sure, but I think that's a cop, and I don't have time to play fiddly fuck with you, much as I'd like to. So be still."
"The babies."
"I'm going to close the doors," Stark said.
They're not tall enough to reach the knobs even when they get up on their feet. They may eat a few dust kitties under the bed, but I think that's the worst trouble they can get into. I'll be back very shortly.
Now the tape was winding figure eights around her ankles. He cut it and stood up again.
You be good, Beth, he said. Don't go losing your happy thoughts. I'd make you pay for a thing like that. But I'd make you watch them pay first.
Then he closed the bathroom door, the bedroom door, and was gone. He absented himself with the speed of a good magician doing a trick. She thought of the .22 locked in the equipment shed. Were there bullets in there, too? She was pretty sure there were. Half a box of Winchester .22 long rifles on a high shelf. Liz began to twist her wrists back and forth. He had interwoven the tape very cunningly, and for a while she wasn't sure she was going to be able to even loosen it, let alone work her hands free of it. Then she started to feel a little give, and began to work her wrists back and forth, faster, panting. William crawled over, placed his hands on her leg, and looked questioningly into her face.
"Everything's going to be fine," she said, and smiled at him.
Will smiled back and crawled away in search of his sister. Liz tossed a sweaty lock of hair out of her eyes with a brisk shake of her head and returned to rotating her wrists back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. 3. So far as Alan Pangborn could tell, Lake Lane was entirely deserted. At least it was entirely deserted as far as he dared to drive in. That was the sixth driveway along the road. He believed he could have driven at least a little farther in safety. There was no way the sound of his car's engine could be heard at the Beaumont place from this distance, not with two hills in between. But it was better to be safe. He drove down to the A-frame cottage, which belonged to the Williams family, summer residents from Lynn, Massachusetts, parked on a carpet of needles under a hoary old pine, killed the engine, and got out. He looked up and saw the sparrows. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.